because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Coach, it is finally here. Go to www.dougnovakbasketball.com today to get three all-access practices, a finishing video, and a full team film session from one of the best basketball educators in the world, Doug Novak of Bethel University. Open the doors and get full access to three practices, one full unedited film session, and a point of attack instructional finishing video. That's www.dougnovakbasketball.com to learn more, or go to www.bivideoproductions.com to see all the ways we are sharing the game. Enjoy the podcast.
Coach, it's a real treat today. Don Showalter is with us, 10-time USA Basketball gold medalist head coach, while serving as head coach of various USA development teams. And in May 2016, he was hired as coach director, USA Basketball Youth and Sport Development Division. And, you know, I know that position has taken him all over the world and continues to help grow the game, not just in America, but the world. Just incredible success as a high school coach as well, won over 600 games, and a wonderful resource to be able to have and to be able to talk to you today. So welcome to the podcast, Coach.
Yeah, I'm happy to be on it. I've listened to your podcast, and you have a great following, so I'm honored to be a part of it.
Well, we're all honored as well, and we're going to get into so many different things, and that's great because I know you can talk about just about anything at this point with all your experience. But let's take you back to your high school coaching and say, if you return to high school coaching right now, what ideas have you learned through all these experiences that would most impact you in your return to high school coaching?
That's a great question because I actually did coach high school basketball during most of the time that I was coaching for USA Basketball as well. So I did actually, I think I actually made a lot of subtle changes with my high school team based on my coaching with USA Basketball on the international level. But first of all, the FIBA rules made me a much better coach. The 24-second shot clock, the fact that players can't call timeout on the court is a huge rule change that I think would make a big difference in basketball and how it's approached in our country. And then just, you know, other small rule changes like advancing the ball in the last 2 minutes of the game in the front court. That's a really good rule change. But so I think all those affected me a little bit from the standpoint that I really felt that sometimes we as coaches depend on the timeout way too much and don't let the kids, players have, just play. And sometimes I think it hurts our preparation. I find out that when I coached international games, be very, very well prepared in the last 10 seconds of the shot clock, last 10 seconds of a game, because they can't be, player can't be dribbling and then call a timeout to set up a play. So I think that's one rule that probably did more than anything to maybe make me a better coach, more prepared coach. Let the kids play a little bit as far as letting them figure things out. One of my big sayings has always been, you know, hey, you figure it out. You're the one that's on the court, and you figure it out. And by doing so, you know, in practice sessions and stuff, that's a great carryover thought for the players. So those are some
Can I stop you real quick just about the shot clock?
Yeah.
I mean, I played 24 for a long time being from Canada, but well, right. Every country in the world plays this role. So
yeah.
What would you say to American coaches that have a fear of going to these type of rules? Forget about the administration of it. Let's say, what can we do to alleviate their fears and tell them that, hey, this is a great game?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I think I've said this on my Twitter account many times, let's get out of the dark ages and get to a shot clock. I just think it makes you a better coach. I really do. I think it makes your players better. I think it makes your players understand the game better from the standpoint they have to now make some plays and have to execute, and makes a better team game, I think, because at the end of a shot clock or during the shot clock, I think you have to have some quick motion stuff, some quick whatever it is you're doing. You can't delay getting into that set. You need to get into the set and then play off that set. So I think that would really be a factor for the shot clock. And I think coaches fear it because it tends to take, I think they, I've heard the excuse that, well, it only helps the really good team. Well, my opinion is it doesn't because let's say you're ahead by 5 or 6 going into the last 2 or 3 minutes of a game with no shot clock. It's going to be to the free throw line every time. Now the team that's behind will get an opportunity to play good defense and get the ball back because at the end of a shot clock, they can have a chance to get a rebound. So it actually will help the team that's behind in many cases. And I think that's one of the fears that coaches have is that, you know, if we're playing a really good team, it's going to just help the team that's a better team.
Coach, the other part of that is obviously players, and maybe from your experience, because you've taken American players that didn't play with this shot clock into the international game where they play with it. And I know from my experiences, so I'm curious from yours, do players enjoy playing this way?
Players love it. I've never had a player. I mean, we've had kids from all over our country. And some use shot clocks, you know, there's a few states that use it, but majority of the kids have not used a shot clock. And we do in our, you know, we use a shot clock all the time in our training camps and our mini camps, but players love to play the shot clock. And very seldom does a shot clock go off, but by same token, it makes the pace of the play really more enjoyable for the players. There's not as much stoppage. The game just flows a lot better. So I've never had a player who said that they did not like the shot clock. And this goes back to 09-10, Brad Beal, Andre Drummond, Michael Gilchrist, that group. That's the first thing that they said when they played with the shot clock is, man, this is great. We wished we had this in high school. So yeah, without a doubt, players have loved it.
Very cool. Well, let's shift back to you were talking about your philosophy of you figure it out, which I love. And that, again, like the shot clock, like this philosophy, it puts responsibility in the player's hands and it takes away the coach from guiding every possession. Can you talk a little bit more about this philosophy?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, as a young coach, I coached high school basketball for 42 years in Iowa here. And I think as a younger coach, I was, you know, you always like to have control. and coaches are no different. And I think coaches sometimes like to have, in my opinion, way too much control. And so I think taking some of that control and putting it on the players is advantageous for the game. It's better for the players. And in the long run, it's certainly better for the coaches because the coaches then will be better prepared, their team and practice situation and stuff. So to me, that's just you talk about coach education. I think that really brings that coaching to the forefront when all this happens, it deals with the players figuring things out. And, you know, I always said, I don't really want to run specific sets to get baskets, but I do want to run a set so they can play out of, if that makes sense.
You know,
now you give them a set that they can play out of and figure it out themselves. Whether it's a horn set, whether it's a, you know, flex cut set, whatever it is, now they can play off of that set. And so as a coach, it really helped me as a young coach when I started coaching, you know, more of the international game, 24-second shot clock. I would give them a set, and then we would go through options off of that set, how to play out of that set. And so now you're giving some of the ownership to your players on that. So I just think in the long run, when you allow the players to figure it out, now you're letting them play basketball instead of trying to control the whole game as a coach. And I think too many young coaches that travel across the country really try to control what their players do. And in many cases, it's not really a fun game to watch when that happens.
Well, it's not a fun game to watch. It's not a fun game to play for players. And that's the part that I think we both have always, when I read your stuff and I get a sense of who you are, I believe it always comes back to player enjoyment of the game, because ultimately almost all the development comes back to that. Do they enjoy the experience of playing basketball and working on their game and practicing and all those things? And I think that's a big part of what shines through with some of the things that you share.
Well, you know, I've always said being part of coach education with USA Basketball, and I give clinics all over the world, really. I said, you're number one coaching youth basketball. And maybe we'll get into this, but just as a quick topic here, you know, your number one responsibility when you coach youth basketball is not skill development. It's not anything else really other than make them, allow them, give them some ways in order to love the game. If you get an 8-9-year-old to love the game, you've accomplished something. And too many coaches don't understand that part of it. You know, they'll try and coach him to death, and the kids, and then that player doesn't enjoy the game. But the enjoyment of the game is by far the most crucial in having players continue to develop on their own. Once they get to an age where, skill development takes over and knowledge of the game. But yeah, if they can enjoy the game, and I always say, even as a high school coach and coaching with the junior national team, we really talk about my assistants and I really talk about how do we make sure that the kids really enjoy what they're doing and enjoy the game, enjoy playing the game. And, you know, a lot of that, and I think the majority of it myself comes from coaches. Players love the game, yes, but they enjoy continue to play the game because of feedback they get from their coach and that goes a long way towards their enjoyment of playing the game and watching it and maybe refereeing it at a later date.
Absolutely. That's great stuff. And Coach, one of my curious questions for you, and we will get into the youth development part of it. That's a big thing, I think, for all of us to be able to think deeper about. But one of the things that struck me is obviously this tremendous success. I mean, 10-time USA basketball, but all the high school success as well. But what are some things that you've done to be able to fight complacency? You know, because again, you know, and I don't mean this negatively, you know that by and large, USA basketball team, you are showing up with athletically, talent-wise, arguably the best roster. But that's hard. That's hard going into those situations knowing you should win certain games. So what are some things that you personally have done to fight this complacency and have this incredible success?
Yeah, you know, I get that question a lot because I think that's probably kind of at the forefront of a lot of our USA basketball teams when we go to international competition. And let me prerequisite that by saying that I really think in my years, 10 years of coaching at the 16 and 17 level, I've always kind of said that if you take our best five players and you play Argentina, who's always really strong, or Spain, or, France right now could be unbelievable in there. But you play any of those teams, and you take their top five, and you couldn't sub. It would be a very, very good game. I mean, I'm not sure we might win 6 or 7 out of 10. I don't think we'd win 10 out of 10, and maybe half might be a better look at it that way. But when we substitute our next seven, and they substitute their next seven, we are really far superior in our kids coming off the bench. So that's really where we make a huge difference in our play at the international level. And so our players, we really hammer that into our players, is that really our first five can be really good, but so are the other team's first five. And now when we get to our bench, we don't drop off. And I think that makes that, that's one reason why we're so strong. And so I go back to that a lot when we're playing and now when we're talking to, you know, our present coaches and our teams and things like that, is that really we want to get into their bench and we want to make sure that our bench coming in is very ready to play. So I think complacency comes when you think you can just do whatever you want to do and win the game. And so, you know, our culture, we really push our players to a really high level. I mean, you know, great players want to be coached. And so you think, I mean, I'm just going through a list here. Jason Tatum comes into our training camp, and he's a great player at U16 and U17. And the word great is, I'll throw this in, is way overused. You know, there's not a lot of great players in the game. There's a lot of really, really good players. But, you know, you take the NBA, I don't think there's probably 20, 25 great players. So having said that, you know, you take a guy like Jason Tatum, those guys come in, they have a great attitude and they want to be coached. So they don't want to be complacent in their play. They don't want to be a player who just goes through the motions. And so they want to be held accountable. Our last team of U17 team that won the gold medal, Jalen Green was a great example of that. Before that, Colin Sexton, you know, I could go down the list, but Jalen Suggs from Minneapolis was unbelievable that way. So I think, you know, the culture that we have is we're not going to allow you as a player to get complacent. And we're going to make sure that we coach each one of you to get better. And so that's our message to players coming in. I think that's a great message for high school coaches to have, is that, you know what, we're going to coach you to get better. And I think sometimes, and I've, you know, in my 42 years, I've had teams that the players didn't really necessarily want to get better, or they thought they were at the place where there wasn't any room for improvement. So that's kind of a long statement to your question, but I really feel that complacency comes from the fact that coaches don't allow that. And we really emphasize that.
It's great. And the other part that obviously leads to you empowering the players, helping 7 through 12 know that they're really important, which is a big part of this process as well for you. But this has also led to, I assume, your pressing philosophy, which you would know a little bit better than I, but my experience is not a lot of teams press internationally like you have committed to through different teams in different year.
Yeah, you know, a part of that goes, I think there's, first of all, that's the way I coach my high school team. We press all the time. Now, again, same with our junior national team. I think the presses from each year look a little different. But, you know, it's to get into their benches, to use our bench because we know our bench is better. And each one of our 12 kids that we pick for those teams are probably going to have a opportunity to play in the NBA. And so we wanted to, you know, I think pressing allows them to play hard. It gives them some open court skills in defending the ball, defending, you know, seeing ball and man and getting steals. And so I think the pressing aspect just from my own high school teams was really benefited. And then also from the national standpoint, our national teams, you know, obviously our physical abilities were so good that our presses were very good at times. But I would say this too, and coaches listening in should be aware that, you know, your philosophy is not really built on a constant over, you know, your philosophy can't be the same for every team. In other words, your philosophy is not based on your team makeup. Your philosophy is based on what you as a coach emphasize. And so we're not always going to have a 1-2-1-1 full court zone press. Some years we did, some years we didn't. But the press may take different forms. I will say this, when Jabari Parker played for us in that group, Jahlil Okafor, it probably wasn't quite as athletic a group as we've had in the past with the junior national team overall. But we were a great three-quarter court, half-court pressing team. I mean, we really did a great job. We were not a very good full-court pressing team. So my philosophy is to press, so now I have to figure out what kind of press each team can do the best. And I think that's a challenge of coaching. That's a challenge you look at. And with our USA teams, that was part of a challenge to come up with. When we had Jaren Jackson, who's playing for the Memphis Grizzlies right now, and Colin Sexton, you know, our best press was our 1-2-1-1 full court zone press. We were devastating in that press just because of length and quickness and everything else that went together on that. But again, you know, I emphasize that that's part of what coaching is all about, how you can fit what you like to do with your team. And you know what? Some years I didn't press as nearly as much as I pressed, but it was for different reasons, you know, slow the ball down as opposed to get steals. And so young coaches, I think, by golly, we're going to play man-to-man regardless of what we got. Well, sometimes that comes back to bite you, as we all know. So I think you have to take your philosophy and adjust it to your teams.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. But curious as well with with your exposure through USA Basketball, you have access to resources, you know, sports science, all these different things, wearable technology, et cetera. So curious how you balance your experience with some of these evidence-based ideas that you have learned through USA Basketball. How much has that shifted some of your philosophy or some of the way that you teach, some of the way that you coach, knowing some of this stuff in terms of the sports science side?
I don't think it really has changed. I don't think that outside, I would say kind of outside data has really influenced our coaching very much at our junior national team level and our USA level. And I think we still have a great feel for what we can do as a team. And, obviously I assume that analytics is kind of what you're getting at as well.
Well, a little bit of that, and then a little bit of obviously the new methods, well, not new methods, but just some of the evidence about how to teach, what to teach, not what to teach, but how to teach in terms of some things. And I'm going to get into that with you. You do some of these things, and I think you've done them throughout your career. Yeah. That might be evidence-based ideas, but you may not frame it that way. But I'll give you a quick example that you place a big emphasis on teaching in sound bites, not in paragraphs. And the reason you do that is to obviously increase their focus. I'll let you talk about that. But one of the main things I would take away from that is that you're increasing their active learning time. You're increasing their time on task. They're not listening, they're playing. So there would be an example. I don't know if you want to talk about that now since I brought it up, but teaching in sound bites.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of practice things that I picked up as a coach that really enhance the player's ability to play the game freely, to make good decisions and all that kind of stuff. And I think as coaches, a couple of things like you mentioned, obviously, I think coaches, we tend to spend way too much time talking in practice. Sometimes I say, don't teach in paragraphs, you teach in sound bites. And that's a Kevin Eastmanism, so to speak. But, it made me a much better coach when I started to just simply give coaching bites just in short sound bites while the kids were actually playing, rather than stop it, explain it. Now, I think when you're starting to teach a drill, and again, I might be going off a little bit here on a tangent, but when you start teaching a skill, then I think you teach a skill. I mean, you explain it. I think there's five parts to it. You explain it, you demo it, have a player demo what you want done, whether it be no matter what skill you're working at. Then you rep it. I mean, your repetition builds a habit. And then you correct it after you rep it. And then you rep it again. Now, those reps can come with competition. Obviously, you put competition in it, it makes it much more game-like. So that's kind of the five steps to teach a skill. Once you teach a skill, now you're in the rep stage. That's when you teach in sound bites. Get those hips lower, keep the chin up. All those things are reminders for the players of what to do to become a better player. And so I think we talk too much in practice, coaches do. And I think I've done a much better job of not talking all the time. Letting the players talk, because pretty soon they don't talk. They want to listen to what you have to say. So let them be the voice at different times during practice. And then I think the second thing, coaches, I think we all do as coaches, at least I did as a young coach, is we repeat ourselves. And anytime you repeat yourself, players don't listen to you the first time because they know you're going to repeat it a second time, maybe a third time. So timeout situation, you're in a close game. You don't have their full attention the first time you say things because, well, he'll say it again. So I'll make sure I get this second time. So I think that's a piece. Those two are critical in just coaching the game for the players, teaching sound bites, and then don't repeat yourself. So for instance, I'll start a drill. I'll say, all right, give me four lines on the baseline with no more than five players in the line. And I will not repeat that. And it's surprising the first time how complicated it is for the players to figure that out. And,
Coach, it's because we don't put them in situations where, as you've said already, they have to figure things out, or they're in positions where they have to lead themselves. Too much is done for players. So I am, this is one of the best things that I definitely have read that you say, and that is don't repeat yourself. I've done that for years, and you've added credibility to it. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I even go so far as at camps, when I teach something and we break off the baskets, the tendency for a camp coach that's with me is to reteach it once they get to the basket.
Right.
And it's, you know, again, you're taking away from active learning time, reps, all those different things. So it's great stuff.
Yeah. And I run a Snow Valley basketball school in the summertime. And, you know, I think that's a great point. When the coach teaches something, don't reteach it again. I mean, that, then get into your competition, your reps, your drills, whatever, for that, because that just allows the players to not pay attention to what's going on the first time. And I think that is a huge mistake that we make as not only just coaches, but just as, you know, when I speak to, I've had a chance to speak to some corporate speeches as well to big companies. I mean, that's the same way it happens. You know, a boss will say something two or three times in a meeting, and it's not a good learning situation. And so I'm fully with you on that. And anything, I think those are two of the things I think would help coaches out tremendously as they coach.
I agree. I agree completely. And I guess where I'm going with some of this too is that I know you get misconstrued just as I do sometimes, that people think that, you know, you do too many blocked reps and I don't do enough blocked reps. I want to just, hey, coach, I want to clarify this because I think we both get it a little bit. Is it hard to judge someone based on just a tweet, right?
Right. Exactly. Really. I hear you. Yep.
But I also want to say just quickly, there's absolutely a need in certain phases of development to build the action without defense, for sure. So these blocked on-air reps. So my question to you is, when do you, with your experience or your knowledge, when do you progress it to start to add load and challenge? Because I know you do. For example, if we talk about line pivots.
Right.
What do you do then is the next phase? Because that's the part people don't see.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you raise a great question, because I think it's got to be a combination of both. And so when you do reps, the reps build the habit. I always go back and say, you know, if you're running a dribble drive offense, which, you know, obviously is a popular offense right now, and we find this out with our USA team too. But if you're going to run, let's say, a dribble drive offense, and two or three of your players can't really use their left hand on the dribble, what happens to that offense? As with any offense, it's not going to be very good. You know, those skills have to be developed in a non-threatening situation. So when you're coaching, and if you're running a dribble drive offense, and I talk to coaches all the time about different offenses, but, you know, if you don't spend time developing a player's weak hand, your offense is going to be unlike what you want it to be, because that just takes away from what your offense can do. So I think you have to spend some time in a non-competitive, non-threatening situation to the player. All right, now let's work on the left hand. So every day in practice, you might do a two-ball dribbling or whatever it is to develop that left hand. Now you can see some progress in that left hand development. Now you can take it into competition off two-on-two or three-on-three things. My dribble pivot pass is probably a great way. One of the things that we do constantly, jump stop, pivot, and pass. That is it's certainly a great way to start the practice, but also develops footwork a little bit. Now, the sequence to that then is, all right, let's put with young kids especially, all right, let's put what we call bowl in the ring. We're going to put a player in the middle now, as you got to pass around or pass through after you've taught the different passing methods, step out, step through, fake a pass, make a pass, those things. Now you put it in. All right, let's put this into a situation where you have to read that defense and get it going from there. So that would be a type of thing, advancement in what we do with, and we just simply call it as progressively coaching in our sayings. And,
can I give you a quick example, Coach, of something? So just so coaches know where I'm thinking is, I am not skipping those steps that you're saying. So I'm not anti what you're saying.
Right.
I am going to start from, say, 3-on-3 and add a constraint where a player dribbles it and goes dead.
Yep.
And now they first experience, why are you teaching them the pivots? What is the point of the pivots? It's to get them out of trouble. It's to create advantage, right. It's these different things. And then I would go back to the line pivots to be able to teach the fundamentals, develop the fundamentals, and then put them back into it. So we're doing the same thing in a different way, but we're doing the same thing. But the value of those things for both of us is there, right?
Hey, Coach, going to interrupt this podcast for a brief message from show partner, Simply Safe. With home security, there's two ways you can go about protecting your home. There's the traditional way where you wait weeks for a technician to do a messy installation that costs a small fortune. Or there's the other way, Simply Safe. Simply Safe is everything you need in a home security system. It's award-winning protection, two-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice Award. Simply Safe blankets your whole home in safety. You get comprehensive protection for your entire home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. You barely notice it's there. But what's truly remarkable is you can set up this system all by yourself. Anyone can do it. It takes 30 minutes to an hour tops. And there's absolutely no trade-offs to your safety. You'll have an army of highly trained security experts ready to dispatch police to your home at a moment's notice 24/7. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. It's why The Verge calls Simply Safe the best home security system. Go to simplysafe.com/team today and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplysafe.com/team. That's simplysafe.com/team. The perfect hire can have an impact on your business for years to come. So when you need to find that next person to help grow your business, LinkedIn Jobs will match the right talent with your open role fast. I personally use LinkedIn, and I know many of you in the coaching profession do too. Did you know LinkedIn has over 675 million members worldwide? LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills you're looking for so you can hire the right person fast. Things like collaboration, creativity, adaptability, LinkedIn looks beyond the work skills and puts your job post in front of qualified candidates who match your business requirements perfectly. That's how LinkedIn makes sure your job post is seen by the people you want to hire, people with the skills, qualifications, and other interests that will help your business grow. It's no wonder a person is hired every 8 seconds with LinkedIn. Find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first 50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/team. Again, that's linkedin.com/team to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Now back to the podcast.
Exactly. And, you know, I will go from there. I mean, that's a little bit of a warm-up drill too, but also then I go, we do a lot of 3-on-3. I mean, that's how you, in my estimation, playing 3-on-3 with different rules and 4-on-4 cutthroat with different rules, that's really teaching how to play the game. I'll give a great example. I think Villanova, Jay Wright, does as good a job with teaching the jump stops as anybody I've ever seen. I mean, you watch his teams play. I just watched a game last night. His teams play, they rarely make a pass without a jump stop. I mean, it's always dribble, jump stop, and then they take the shot or the pass off that. And so I go watch his practices, and that's exactly what he does. I mean, he, in 3-on-3, 4-on-4, that's his point of emphasis. And so that's a great, what you said is a great way to do it. And that's kind of the whole part whole method. And, you know, so from that standpoint, then you take that 3-on-3 or 4-on-4 and say, all right, you know what? We need to do a little better job of, let's start at the half court line and let's go, one-on-one, going, using your left hand, getting to the kill area, which is the elbow area, and now making a pass from there. So now you're kind of breaking it down again, but keeping that competition with it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's funny because I think both you and I have the same kind of concept, but obviously some people don't think we do.
Well, this is what I'm trying to clarify a little bit. And I'll even go further with you saying speaking in short bursts. Yeah. I like coaches to understand you run drills in short bursts as well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Right? Like you might do line pivots for a minute, 2 minutes some days, just like you said with the Jay Wright stuff as emphasis.
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, that's, there's so many coaches, Chris, across the country that really don't know how to coach. I shouldn't say it, but that's just a standpoint. I mean, we can all be coaches, but we can't all be good coaches. That makes sense. And so what we try and do is we try and give some help to coaches. All right, here's how you can be a better coach by doing this and this and this. So when you talk about practice things, you know, if you have 5 minutes for a drill and that drill, it completely sucks after 5 minutes, which happens. Don't belabor that and go another 5 minutes because it just gets worse. So coaches, like you said, hey, just do it for 2 or 3 minutes as a point of emphasis and then move on, whether it's really good or not, because sometimes those aren't really, and come back with it the next day and, or put that same drill later on in practice. And which I think is really a good coaching methodology for those.
No question.
You get me going on a lot of different tangents here. So I apologize.
Honestly, but no, don't apologize, because that's what this is designed for. This is us as coaches talking. And honestly, if you or I were up late at night at Snow Valley, we would get into the same conversation.
No question. We have a coach's clinic there. And yeah, it gets, I mean, you throw people in a lot of different ideas, and that's how you learn. And as a young coach, and Chris, that's how I went to clinics and I worked camps to learn the game. Nowadays, young coaches, they don't go to clinics and they don't work camps. So how are they going to learn? Well, they can learn some on the internet, obviously YouTubes and the podcasts and stuff, which is great. I mean, that's how they learn. But, you know, I always said, it's not really what you teach, it's how you teach it. And so you do not get the how by just watching a YouTube drill. You know, you don't, if you watch my line drills, you don't really get the full benefit by watching it on YouTube. You know, it's what's being taught, but it's not really how it's being taught, you know, the things that go with it. So I certainly encourage, I mean, I think coaches really need to, if they're really serious about becoming a great coach, a better coach, they need to figure out how things are taught. And I'll go back to when I first graduated from college, I wrote a handwritten letter to John Wooden. I said, "Coach, I would love to work your camp." And he wrote me a handwritten letter back. This was 1974. And that first year, he said, we're filled, but you keep my name on the list. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, right. My name will be on his list. But then, he gave it to the guy who directed the camp. And a week before the first camp started, he called and wanted to know if I wanted to be a counselor at the camp. So that's how I got started with that. You have to really take some initiative. And I tell coaches all the time that get out of your comfort zone and take some initiative with how you're going to develop your coaching theory. I think another thing, too many coaches want to get to a level that they think they want to get to too quickly. And where they're at is never quite good enough. I mean, we all know those guys, Chris, the level they're at is not quite, they don't want to be there forever, but they don't want to stay there too long either. So they're always looking at the next, hey, how can I go the next? I tell coaches all the time, I said, the first thing you do, if you want to advance in the coaching profession, no matter where you're at, if you're coaching fifth grade girls team, the number one thing you have to do is you better do a great job where you're at. If you don't do a great job where you're at, you're not going to get a chance for so-called advancement or whatever else you want. And, you know, I tell employees this all the time as well when I speak to corporate groups. You better do a great job. If you're, you know, if you're the low man on the totem pole, you better do a great job of that. If you don't, how do you think you're going to get moved so-called up the ladder? And I think the same with coaching.
Such great points, Coach. And I just want to reemphasize, like my 20 to 25 year, during my age 20 to 25, I got in the car and I worked basketball camps. I was Canadian, but throughout the U.S., throughout everywhere. And that has become harder for coaches, in fairness, because I think there's a lot more restrictions, NCAA rules, different things like that. Right. But what we've tried to do with our basketball immersion community is the part that you don't see behind, again, just the website, is we have a community where it's a private mastermind group where coaches can engage in a lot of these conversations. Right. And my intent, it was to create exactly what you just said. You used to be able to get it. Now, we can't completely do it because there's nothing like in person. But I just love how you brought that out and brought that up, because it's such a huge part of learning.
Yeah.
Is those discussions where you don't agree with someone and you have a conversation about it.
Yep. And then you strengthen your thoughts and feelings about that aspect of the game of basketball, because now you have to explain it. You have to really think about it as well. Yeah. And I know, Chris, you've done a great job just for the overall game of basketball. I mean, I just appreciate so much what you're doing for the game of basketball, taking it to another level for many, 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 many coaches. And I think that's, from a USA Basketball coach director, that means so much to me personally and to USA Basketball.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, Coach. And let's jump into something else that I think is outstanding that you do. And I assume you still did it. And I'm curious if you started this back in high school. The technical term or the scientific term is a sociogram, which is basically a graphic representation of social links that a person has. So the way you did this is that you did team surveys, right? Where you said, who's the hardest worker? Who's the best teammates? Who's the best defender? Who's the best rebounder? And it basically creates this understanding or plots the structure of all these interpersonal relationships in a group. And I've used these ever since I learned about the sociogram concept. And I just think it's outstanding that you do it. And you do it from USA on down to your high school team, I assume?
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Can you explain why? Because I think this is such an important thing for coaches to understand.
Well, I think, you know, just how we do things, I pass out a questionnaire several times during the year. And the question would be, I think this is what you're referring to, would be, who would be who are the three hardest workers on our team? Who would you want to take the last second shot? Who, we're down by two and we need a defensive stop. Who are three guys you would really want to play with to have that happen? All those kind of questions. First of all, that is so revealing, number one. We don't have them write their names on or anything. So when we look at those, it's revealing, number one. Number two, it gives you a great idea of the roles of your players on your team. So yeah, I'll give you a great example. When I was at City High here coaching, I gave my best player, was really a very talented player, but you know what? He was not what I would call a hard worker. And that, I don't think that's unusual, because I think as coaches, we have a lot of players sometimes that we think are our best players, but they sometimes think they're little prima donnas or whatever. And that happens once or twice on our junior national team as well. So when I did this, there wasn't one player in the room and of all those that had him as one of the top three players that worked the hardest. I mean, he could have put himself down and he didn't even put himself down. I don't know whether he didn't think he could or not. So that's a great starting point for me to say, you know, this isn't me telling you that I don't think you're working hard at times. This is what your teammates say. You were not listed one time by anybody as being our three hardest workers. And that in itself turned his whole thought process around. I mean, from then on, it was like night and day. So that's just one example that I use that has really made a complete turnaround in one of our players. And you can use it from the standpoint of, you know, this is what your teammates say about you. All right. So another thing is, who are the three best, maybe who are three best defenders on your team? So I would share this with the team. All right. You guys have said that Joe, Johnny, and Bob are the top three defenders. And I would share this with the team. So what that does is that really sets them apart, and that's their role on the team. Hey, you know what? Bob thinks my teammates think I'm a really good defender. That's really what I'm going to take ownership in and be a great defender. So it kind of sets the tone for roles without me as a coach saying, hey, your role is a defender, your role is a rebounder, your role is this, your role is this. So I think it takes a lot of that away from the coach and makes it more player team, as more from the players than it does the coach. And I think anything we can do to make it a player's team, we're better. I mean, all the great teams I've had are always player driven as opposed to coach driven, if that makes sense.
Totally. And, you know, absolutely.
And our junior national teams, we really worked hard on making that their player's team. Now, that doesn't come easy and it doesn't come naturally. But I think over time, we don't have a lot of time with those kids, but we do have some mini camps leading up to those and stuff. So you can get that established in that, you know, this team is really made up of you players, and this is your team. We're just here to guide you. And when they think that, and when they see that we're not there to criticize, be critical all the time, we're there to guide them, that means a little bit different than if we're there to always correct, always to criticize. Just that term, I think, makes a big difference. So we use those questionnaires a lot. We'll do it probably at least twice a year during my high school year. And we'll do it with our junior national team as well. We'll do it after our first.
Tremendous. And the coach nowadays, obviously coaches that know, they can use Google Forms and different things like that.
Yeah.
Easier, because inevitably players are ready to do it on their phone.
Exactly.
Tremendous. Yeah, really good.
What I do, Chris, on that is I just turn that over to my assistant, because they have much more knowledge on how to do that on the phone than I do. So
that's great. That's great. Coach, let's circle back a little bit to, because I did want to come back to youth player development, especially, and talked about making it fun for them, instilling a love of the game. So can you just give us some examples, some best practices that you share with coaches to be able to help this? Because again, the number one thing for retention in the sport is obviously that they enjoy it, but also that they see themselves getting better.
Right, right. I think we need to our players, especially at a young age, you need to define what fun is, you know, because fun has a lot of different meanings for kids and for parents. And so I always, my definition of fun is really simple. And I use this with my fifth grade. I have a grandson that's 9 years old. And so when I go talk to his team, fun is doing something hard well. That's my definition of fun. So when a kid can use his left, like, maybe he's doing a two-ball dribble and now he's left-handed, he's getting better and better and better at it. That's a hard thing to do, but when he does it well, that's fun. And so that's how I describe what fun is. Fun isn't pulling down somebody's shorts in front of you. You know, fun isn't, you know, making fun of somebody who can't do a skill. That's not fun. And so those have to be corrected in a practice situation for all levels. Or, you know, trying to do something. I mean, we all understand what goes on in cases where young players are doing some things that they think is fun, but really isn't. So I think the definition of fun is doing something hard well. And so when you establish that, now players, hey, you know what, I can do this left-hand layup as a young player. You know what? You spend time and time and time with a young player doing a left-hand layup, and all of a sudden they get it. Then you always say, hey, is that fun? Yeah, that's fun. So, and I obviously communicate that to parents all the time as well. When you know, we always have, Chris, I'm sure we all know that one of the big things is, well, when a parent's trying to work around playing time, you know, they always work around it. They want their son to have more playing time or daughter to have more playing time. The word, well, they're not having any fun, always comes out, doesn't it? And so I think
it always does.
So I think you need to establish, all right, well, you tell me what fun is. And they can't explain what fun is. So I think then you have to tell them, here's what fun is, and here's how we go about doing it. So again, kind of a long story there with that. But and then I think in order to really love the game, think about why we're in coaching to start with. I mean, I got in coaching because my sixth grade coach was awesome. I loved him. I would do anything for him. And I think those of us who get into coaching, somebody has made us love the game. If we didn't love the game, we would still be in coaching. It's not for the money. It's not, you know, it's not for anything else. It's because we love the game and we just want to help kids. So when we take that into account, what were some of those attributes of that coach who had a great effect on you? And I talk about this in clinics all the time. So it wasn't a yeller and a screamer. It wasn't somebody who yelled and screamed at you all the time. That would make me not love the game. I wouldn't want to go back. My goal, I tell my goal for coaches, your goal as coaches, you want your kids to go home and can't wait to get back to practice. Now, how are they going to do that? Well, if they think they're getting better, they're going to want to come to practice. If you're a positive guy that they want to be around, you're going to come back. They're going to come back to practice. I think those are some of the key things. I always say teaching the sandwich method. You know, you give them a positive. Hey, Billy, that was a great rebound. Then you say, but Billy, you can be a better rebounder if when the ball goes up, you get in the pathway of that, and then you end up with another positive. If you do that, you're going to get two or three more rebounds a game. So I just call it the sandwich method. And tell my assistants, I said, anytime correcting is great, but be sure that they know what they've done right first. And they feel good about it. And just little things like, you know, players love to hear their name called. Yes. You know, you can say, hey, great rebound. But if you say, hey, Billy, that was a great rebound, all of a sudden, you know what? They feel really good because you called them out on that. You use their name, and they feel good about that. And then that makes them love the game, coach, and also establishes kind of some roles without telling them that's a role. So every time Billy makes a great rebound, if you say, Billy, that's a great rebound, all of a sudden he starts taking pride in that and saying, you know what? That must be what I do really well is a rebound. So again, kind of a long explanation for what you had, but I think loving the game comes so much from the coaching aspect of it. And, you know, you're not going to have every kid love the game the same way or the same level. You know, not everybody loved the game the same level I did. Some of us, as you know, are just basketball crazy and love the game regardless. And other people can't quite figure that out at times. But I think in the long run, you can really help kids loving the game. And even if they don't stay with it, they're going to love the game in other aspects. They might be, like I said, they might go into the referee, be an official, which we desperately need more officials in the game. They may not play forever, but they could coach their, be a coach at the youth level. They don't have aspirations of being a coach at another level. So a lot of different aspects go into that, but I really think the bottom line is how can you make them love the game?
Love it. Absolutely. It's a big part of it. And the part that resonates for me is that since you know this is true, and we all do know this is true, that players like to see themselves get better, to feel like they're getting better, it's so important for you as a coach to notice their progress. To just spend time every day noticing their progress, something they couldn't do, and now something they can do better. Not perfect, better. Yeah. I think that's the part that resonates for me about what you said.
No question. You know what? Just a comment here. We have what we call gold standards. It was really initiated by Coach K with his Olympic team back in 2008, maybe 12, where he had a list of gold standards. And if coaches have not read that book by Coach K called Gold Standards, I think you need to read that. But so we do that same thing with our high school team and with our junior national team. We have a list of gold standards. And some of those, one of those is trust. And players, I think, if they really cannot love the game unless they trust you as a coach. And trusting is something that you build on a daily basis between coach and player, with relationships, with whatever. So if I tell a player something that is not true, his trust in me certainly is not the level you want. I'll give you an example. Early on in my career, players love socks for gifts. I don't know why. They love socks. So whoever won the free throw contest that we were doing that day, I would give a free pair of socks to. Well, I didn't have the socks with me at that time. I had to go down and dig out of our apparel stuff. So I didn't do it right afterwards, and I kind of forgot about it. And so like 2 weeks later, a player comes back to me and says, hey, I was supposed to get a pair of socks for winning those free throws. Oh, yeah. He said, I'll give it to you here soon, as soon as I can get down and get them. Well, you know, that's a trust factor. And so if you say something, then you better do it with players. And that's why it's very important that when you make a promise that you follow through on that. And you can take it at a different level. I mean, you can say, you know, if you tell a six player, all right, if you can do these things, I'm going to start you. He does those things and you don't start him, you've lost all trust. So be careful, be really careful of what you promise or what you say to players, because they hear things a little different than what you sometimes mean. And so over the years, I've learned from being a young coach to a much more experienced coach, I don't promise anything. I say this, you know, I let them know this is a possibility, but I never promise anything, because at the end of the day, if you can't come through with that promise, then you've lost all that trust with that player. So that's kind of a side note to what we're talking about.
No, but an important part that goes with it. There's no question about that. So, Coach, maybe one last thing that I want to touch on, which again, I'm sure you hear enough of and I do as well, is this concept of zone. Players, yeah. And I think you're on record of saying basically before the eighth grade, there shouldn't be pressing and there shouldn't be anything other than half court, man-to-man. But the reality is USA Basketball has no method of enforcing this, right?
Right.
Is that the challenge for USA Basketball? Because say in other countries, and I think coaches don't understand, in other countries, say in Canada, Basketball Canada, down to the provincial organizations, controls basketball outside of high school basketball. So these rules can be mandated. But the problem is USA Basketball doesn't have that jurisdiction, so to speak. Right. Is that right?
Exactly. We work with the junior NBA along with USA Basketball, and we come up with recommendations. It's a recommendation. But, you know, obviously, you know, whoever's running the tournament for the day, they can put in their own rules and regulations dealing with that.
And AAU does not have a recommendation, or they do not have a policy? Is that right?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't. And, you know, the AAU term is really probably not the term it used to be. I mean, now it's club teams are not necessarily AAU teams. So that's the whole different aspect of, you know, of the game of basketball. But, yeah, there's nothing that says you can't play zone. So here, for instance, I go to my grandson's 9-year-old game, and they're playing a team is playing a 1-3-1 half court trap. And I'm just going, you got to be kidding.
For development, eh? Awesome for development.
Yeah awesome. I'm just going, you know, and there's no way they have the experience nor the skill level to attack a 1-3-1 zone with any kind of consistency in that. So I'm pretty adamant. I mean, I just say, you know what, if you're playing zone at anything below 13, you're playing zone because it's all about you as a coach. It's not about the kids. And I'm pretty firm on that. I said, don't be telling me that the only thing you're concerned about is winning the game. If you're playing zone at a young age, there's no other reason. because you're not certainly developing those players to play any kind of defense or understand the game at all. You're not helping them out, because everybody at a young age has a player that's like head and shoulders above everybody else. And if they want to win the game, they're going to plop him right in the middle of the lane, and that kid is going to get every rebound, and he's going to, most of the time I've seen, dribble down the court by himself without passing the ball and shoot it five or six times until it goes in. And the other four players are running down the court watching him do this. And so you cannot convince me that you are in the game for the right reasons other than you're selfish and want to claim a fifth grade, 9-year-old tournament championship if you play zone. And that might seem pretty harsh, but that's where I'm coming from.
It's not harsh, but the reality is that, again, since you can't administer the problem away,
right,
which I think, again, so many coaches spend this endless debate on administering this problem away. Well, yep, you can administer the problem away. So you've got to deal with it, and you've got to prepare your players the best you can to be able to succeed regardless. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't fight the good fight, right?
Exactly. Now, obviously, once you get to high school age, 14, then, you know, that's part of strategy. You know, you develop zone. You know, I've played zone in high school. It's not something that you absolutely say, no, you never play, because once down the road, when you get to high school level, 14, 15, 16, now you are trying to win games. So you're doing things that are allowing your kids to have a chance to compete and to win. But if those kids at a young age, if all they know is zone defense, and you at age 13 and 14 are trying to make them play man-to-man, it's going to be a long haul. You're not going to be able to instill that man-to-man defense that you want to instill starting at age 14 if they've never played it.
Good point. Simple. Wonderful. Coach, just in departing here, and thanking you for being on the podcast, any last thoughts you'd want to share with the basketball community?
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, there's a lot that goes into coaching, but at the end of the day, coaches have tremendous influence in the lives of young people, young players. And so if you take that seriously and understand that the influence you do have, I think it makes your job seem like it has, it has a lot of value to it. And I think that's what we all want with coaches is, all right, you're a coach of a team. Now, you have to, you know, this is a huge thing for these kids, and you have a lot of value as a coach, and it takes some work, and at the end of the day is, make them love the game. And if players see you're working at it as hard as to improve as hard as you want them to improve, I think that's huge. I think my players over the years, when they knew I was working camps and going to clinics and speaking at clinics, I think that gave them a little more initiative to improve their game as well, because they knew how hard myself and our staff was working to get better. So that's my point to coaches too. We want our players to get better. Attend some clinics. We have USA Basketball Academies around the country, 6 of them this year. So, those are opportunities that will show your kids that really you're not satisfied with what level you're at. You want to get better as well. I think that means a lot to the players.
Well, I can't thank you enough for all your sharing and all the things that you've done as part of USA Basketball to give back to the game. So thank you for taking some time and spending it with us.
Thanks, Chris. And one of these times, you and I will get together in person and have some great discussions.
Cannot wait for that. And the steak. And the steak that inevitably comes with it, Coach, because that's another famous part of your Twitter.
Absolutely. I'm a steak guy all the way, as many people know.
Love that. Thanks.
Wait, don't turn off the podcast yet. I want to thank you for listening to the podcast. I know these are challenging times, so it is important to invest into something that is going to contribute to your growth. I am happy the podcast has done that for many coaches. According to one of our members, Coach Paul, this website, the Basketball Immersion Membership Community, will improve you as a coach and challenge your thinking. Everything is well explained, and the unique perspectives on the game will stimulate your learning. Sign up today. You won't regret it. Coaches, email me, DM me, contact me, and I will help you become a member during these challenging times so you can continue to stimulate your thinking.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.